to be American. This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
As the story goes, when Benjamin Franklin was leaving the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, a woman asked him whether the delegates had created a monarchy or a republic. His famous response, "A republic, if you can keep it." That warning feels especially resonant today. Our democratic institutions face intense strain. Structural features of the Constitution, such as the Electoral College, the Senate's equal representation of the states, and the powers of the Supreme Court, have produced a system that can feel distant from majority rule. At the same time, the country confronts extreme political polarization, persistent racial inequality, and declining civic engagement. Free speech, both on campus and in public discourse, is also under pressure, shaping the debates we have about politics and society. All of this raises a fundamental question. Is the Constitution equipped to sustain American democracy in the 21st century? Today's guest has thought deeply about these questions. Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of Berkeley Law School in California. He's also the author of numerous important books, including most recently, No Democracy Lasts Forever, How the Constitution Threatens the United States, and Campus Speech and Academic Freedom, A Guide for Difficult Times. His accolades are too numerous to mention, but here's just one. In 2024, National Jurist magazine named Dean Chemerinsky as the most influential person in legal education in the United States. Erwin, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to get to talk with you.
So your most recent books have pretty ominous titles. No Democracy Lasts Forever. But of course, we're the oldest modern democracy. Are we really at risk of losing it?
No democracy lasts forever. Democracies are there until they're not. We're all familiar with countries in the world that once were democracies, but no longer could claim that title. I've never been so afraid or imagined being so afraid for the future of American democracy as I am now. It would just be hubris to believe that the United States is immune from the pressures that have caused other democracies to fail. The institutions of government have the lowest levels of approval that we've seen since these have been measured. This includes Congress and the Supreme Court. Key institutions of our society, higher education, the media, likewise have their lowest approval ratings. As you said a moment ago, our country is deeply polarized. And we have a president who, whether you agree or disagree with him, is certainly challenging constitutional boundaries. I don't think we've ever seen a president violate so much of the Constitution and laws of the United States so quickly. So all of this leads me to say, yes, we could lose democracy. I'm not saying we will, but I am saying it's in danger.
Yeah, so the alarms are going off, and we need to act quickly, in your view, I think, to try to save democracy. And I want to get into some of those solutions. But, you know, one of the important insights that I think people should recognize is that this is not just a critique of Donald Trump, right? I mean, some of the things you're discussing with respect to the erosion of democracy date back to the 1960s and 1970s, and that helped to create the environment where someone like Donald Trump is able to flourish. So tell us a little bit more about that recent history and what happened in the 1960s and 70s that has led us to today.
The choices that were made in drafting the Constitution, and they were necessary at the time, have come to haunt us. And I know we're going to talk about things like why the Electoral College is more of a threat to democracy now than it was, say, the 20th century. Why two senators per state is a real problem. Why partisan gerrymandering is so much more of a threat when it comes to the House of Representatives being Democratic than it used to be. Why life tenure for Supreme Court justice is a problem. Why the Supreme Court's decisions over the last couple of decades have exacerbated the problem. These are the things that I focus on in the book, and it's interesting how these happened chronologically over time, and they certainly, when taken together, create the threat to democracy that I was focused on in the book.
So let's go through each one of them. The Electoral College. Many people say that the Electoral College protects small states. It means that the cities don't get to just decide, and the coasts, right, the East and West coasts, don't get to decide who's the president for the entire country. Doesn't the Electoral College protect smaller states?
Sure, it protects smaller states, but it does so by depriving the majority of the people in some instances from choosing their president. I believe that in a democracy, it's the people who should choose who's the chief executive of the United States. And states aren't what's represented in our country. It's the people who are represented. I think the Electoral College was a terrible mistake when it was adopted. It was based on a great distrust of the people. It was also based on a desire to help protect Southern states with enslaved populations have more political strength. It didn't matter in the 20th century. There was never an instance in the 20th century where the candidate who lost the popular vote became president of the Electoral College. It's happened twice already in this century, in 2000 and 2016. It almost happened in 2004 and in 2020. Because of demographic shifts and partisan realignment, it's likely to continue to be a real problem in the future. And so I'll answer your question by saying, yes, I think the Electoral College does protect small states, but when it does so by denying the people their choice as president, it's profoundly and undesirably anti-democratic.
How do we convince people to get rid of the Electoral College when politics is so wrapped up in this? I mean, to put a finer point on it, Republicans don't want to get rid of the Electoral College because they're winning under it, right?
And small states don't want to get rid of the Electoral College because it gives them undue political strength. So I think at this point in time, there isn't a path to getting rid of the Electoral College. No way you can get 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the states. I think if John Kerry had won the presidency in 2004, and he would have, despite losing the popular vote, if he carried Ohio, then you would have had a Republican win in the Electoral College in 2000, George W. Bush, and a Democrat in 2004, I think there could have been bipartisan support for changing it. Now it's perceived as benefiting Republicans, but there is a reform that could happen. Congress could pass a law eliminating winner-take-all. Winner-take-all is not a constitutional requirement. In all but Maine and Nebraska, the candidate that wins the popular vote gets all of the electoral votes. So if somebody voted for Donald Trump in California in 2024, or somebody voted for Kamala Harris in Texas in 2024, their vote doesn't count at all. I think if we went to more proportionate allocation of delegates to the Electoral College from each state, we'd significantly decrease the chances that the losing candidate of the popular vote could end up as president of the United States.
Yeah, and I use that Ohio John Kerry example as well in 2004, and note that he only lost Ohio by a pretty small percentage. And so there was a real chance to have two elections in a row where the popular vote winner and the Electoral College vote winner were not the same, but it would have been opposite politically. But because that didn't happen, I think you're right that the politics of the reform make it difficult. Now, you suggested this potential congressional law that would require states to allocate electoral votes proportionally. You mentioned how Maine and Nebraska do that sort of. They allocate Electoral College votes based on congressional districts. So let's say Congress said you had to allocate your electoral votes based on congressional districts. You still have a big problem because of partisan gerrymandering. So tell us a little bit about your views on how those would interact and the issue of partisan gerrymandering.
You're absolutely right. If electors in the Electoral College were allocated based on congressional districts, partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts would undermine the reform. But I think that the problem here is we should get rid of partisan gerrymandering for congressional districts. As you know so well, partisan gerrymandering isn't anything new. It comes from a practice that was early in American history. It's where the political party that controls the legislature draws election districts to maximize, say, seats for that party. The governor of Massachusetts, early in American history, Elbridge Gerry, engaged in the practice, and ever since it's been known as gerrymandering. But it's changed because of sophisticated computer programs, detailed voter information. It's possible to engage in partisan gerrymandering with far more precision than ever before. Jocelyna Kagan, a dissent in Rucho versus Common Cause, said, this isn't your grandparents' partisan gerrymandering. And of course, we've seen the effects of it just in 2026. We've seen Texas and California try to engage in mid-decade partisan gerrymandering to create more Republican and Democratic seats in Congress, respectively. We've seen other states do this, though, to gain less than five seats. I think a tragically wrong decision was the Supreme Court's ruling in Rucho versus Common Cause in 2019, where the Supreme Court said that federal courts cannot hear challenges to partisan gerrymandering. This, too, could be fixed by Congress. Congress could pass a law requiring for congressional districts that there be independent, nonpartisan commissions to end partisan gerrymandering. But I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, of course, that requires the political will. We're speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, the dean of Berkeley Law and the author of No Democracy Lasts Forever. Speaking of the Supreme Court in that 2019 Rucho case, the Supreme Court is supposed to be nonpartisan. And I think if you ask the justices, they would all tell you that they're just trying to discern the law separate from their political beliefs. Do you think they've gone away from that ideal?
I don't think that ideal has ever been possible in American history. Marbury versus Madison was the result of the ideology of John Marshall and wanting to create judicial review. McCulloch versus Maryland was a result of the ideology of John Marshall with regard to the relationship between the federal government and the states. In 1936, there was a very conservative Supreme Court that struck down over 200 laws protecting workers and consumers. It was about the ideology of the justices. The Warren Court, the most liberal court in history, handed down many liberal rulings for desegregation and protecting rights of criminal defendants, protecting voting rights, because the liberal ideology of those justices. And today we have a court with six conservatives. Not surprisingly, they've done things like overrule Roe versus Wade, eliminate the ability of college and university to engage in affirmative action, expand gun rights, obliterate the wall separating church and state. It's all about the values of the justices. This isn't new. It's always going to be that way. And it's not just the Supreme Court. When I have an argument in the Court of Appeals, the first thing I want to know is, who's on my panel? And I can look sometimes and say, unless I mess up, I should win. And there's times that I look and I go, I could let my puppy argue and I have no chance. This isn't new. The legal realists taught us all in the early 20th century how much the values of those making decisions matter in the outcome of those rulings.
So we've talked about the Electoral College. We touched upon the Senate, two senators per state. We discussed partisan gerrymandering and the House. Underlying a lot of this is the problem of race, which I know in your book you argue is baked into the Constitution, both historically and today. So how is race still relevant to our constitutional debates?
Race is enormously relevant. As you point out, it has been since the very beginning of American history. Some of the fiercest debates throughout American history have related to race. When the Constitution was drafted, it could have, but it didn't, eliminate the institution of slavery or chip away at the institution of slavery. Instead, the Constitution protected the institution of slavery. You can see this in things like the Three-Fifths Clause, that enslaved people count as three-fifths of a person for allocating seats in the House of Representatives. You can see it in the provision of the Constitution that Congress couldn't ban the importation of additional enslaved people for 20 years. You see it in the Fugitive Slave Clause. In the early 19th century, until the Civil War, every political issue was fought out, either directly or indirectly, about slavery. And then you have, from 1896 to 1954, the court adopting the doctrine of separate but equal, when separate was anything but equal. And we continue to deal with this legacy today. Look at the percentage of Black individuals or Latino individuals who live below the poverty line compared to white individuals. Or we can look at wealth and the difference in wealth in a family entirely on the basis of race. You look at morbidity and mortality. Lifespan for Black individuals, Latino individuals, is significantly less than white individuals. And I can go on and on with this. This is all the legacy of the constitutional choices made in 1787.
So you say that we could even break as a country without serious changes. You suggest that states might actually secede from the Union. That's a pretty bold statement. Do you think that we could actually be leading toward essentially a civil war or states breaking off?
I am not advocating it by any means.
Of course not.
I'm not saying that I think it's likely, but I do think that there is the underlying question that many people are asking. Is what unites us as a country greater than what divides us as a country? And it's interesting that opinion polls show, both among Democrats and Republicans, that they regard the possibility of secession as plausible. I don't think it would be in the form of a civil war. It could be in the form of a substantial devolution of power. But there's efforts to get an initiative on the ballot in California called CalExit. My hope is we will have a future president, Republican or Democratic, who will try to unify the country. But if we continue on this very divisive path, it's certainly plausible to me that the pressures could tear the country apart.
All right. Well, this is a show called Democracy Optimists, so I want to get to some solutions here. One of them you suggest is really bold, a new constitutional convention to completely rewrite the Constitution. So first, how could we even make that happen?
It's not something that I think is going to happen imminently. It's probably not going to happen in my lifetime. But there will be a point where this country will draft a new constitution. No constitution lasts forever. And our constitution is deeply flawed in many ways. And I think there will be pressure to try to fix it. Congress could create a constitutional convention. The states, pursuant to Article 5, could call for a constitutional convention. We'd have to work out the procedures for how to do it, but there's certainly mechanisms for it to happen.
And what would you want that constitution to say?
I'd want that constitution to carry forward much of what's terrific about our current constitution. I think the concept of checks and balances and separation of powers has worked well. I think the rights in the Bill of Rights and then subsequent amendments work well. But I also think there are serious problems in the Constitution that we need to address. We've touched on them. I think we should eliminate the Electoral College. I think we should eliminate two senators per state. We should make sure that the House of Representatives is not subject to partisan gerrymandering. We should eliminate life tenure for Supreme Court justices. But I also think there's other problems that we've seen. To me, part of the genius of the Constitution was to take two branches of government for any major action. To adopt a law should take Congress and the president. To enforce a law by prosecution should take the executive branch and the courts. To put somebody on a court or an ambassador or a cabinet position takes the president and the Senate. To have a treaty, it should take the president and the Senate. We've strayed very far from that model. I think it started during the Depression. It's accelerated since World War II. Let's take the example of war powers. We're at a moment in time when the president can wage war without any semblance of congressional authority or even a need to justify to Congress that war. That can't be reconciled with separation of powers and checks and balances. I'm teaching constitutional law this semester. We covered war powers earlier in the semester. And when the war began in Iran, I said to my students to think back to what we talked about. Is it consistent with the Constitution? What about the War Powers Act? And if there's no enforcement mechanisms and the president can do whatever the president wants, how then do we have separation of powers and checks and balances? That's part of what I want a new constitution to fix.
Maybe this is a strange question for someone who wrote a book called No Democracy Lasts Forever. But are you optimistic about voting and elections?
I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I'm worried. I think that what we've seen from President Trump is repeated calls to nationalize elections, to try to impose greater restrictions on it to vote, like requiring proof of citizenship in order to register to vote, claims that were just absolutely false about what occurred in the 2020 presidential election. So I think that the safeguard that we have is the decentralization of American elections, that they're held at the state level, that no president, not the current one or a future one, can exercise control. But if the president is able to do what he wanted to do, then I am very worried.
And so what's one thing you think that listeners can do to support democracy?
I think there's many things. First, I think it's so important that people be informed and help to inform others. I've heard too many people say, the news is too depressing. I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to watch. We can't afford that at this moment in time. And the listeners who are informed need to help inform others. We do a poor job of civic education in this country. We need to be going into middle schools and high schools and Rotary clubs and educate people. Second, I think it's really important that people get involved. And there's so many ways of getting involved. And I'm saying nonpartisan, getting involved in local community activities, getting involved in nonpartisan organizations, getting involved in the organizations that are fighting back right now. They need the people power. They need the financial support. And third, I think it's so essential that we speak out. If we see an injustice, we can't be silent about it. I think our generation will be judged 5, 10, 50 years from now as we judge those who came before us at difficult times. And I think the question is, will our generation be condemned for capitulating to things that threaten democracy, or will we be praised for our courage in standing up and fighting for the Constitution?
Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of the University of California, Berkeley Law School, and the author of No Democracy Lasts Forever. Erwin, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much for having me. Truly a pleasure.
So Erwin Chemerinsky sounds very worried about the future of American democracy. Josh, what among the concerns that he talked about stands out to you as one that we ought to all be paying attention to?
I think the structural issues, in particular, the partisan gerrymandering, and as he noted, it's happened, you know, ever since we've been a country, but the fact that it's become so much more sophisticated and so much more enduring, and so therefore has been harmful in a stronger way, is something that I think we're not talking about a lot. You know, one question I was going to ask him was what one Supreme Court case should people know about? But he kind of answered the question already when he mentioned the 2019 Supreme Court case of Rucho versus Common Cause, where the Supreme Court said it's going to stay out of these questions of partisan gerrymandering, that it's not going to police states in the way they draw the lines. And predictably, what we've seen, because states now know that there's no federal oversight, is that partisan gerrymandering has run rampant even more than it had previously. So to me, that was one of the biggest messages of his concern, are these structural problems with our democracy.
Speaking of the Supreme Court, Chemerinsky offered an interesting view about the Supreme Court, that we've always had a high court that's influenced by the ideologies of its justices. But where does that leave us, Josh? Don't we need to be able to trust that the court's determining the law of the land free of ideological influence?
Yeah, and you know, one thing that's interesting is that it's true that the court has always been ideological, but I'm not so sure it's been as partisan as it is today. And here's what I mean by that. Right now, we've got 6 Republican appointees who are conservative and 3 Democratic appointees who are more liberal. Previously, we would have justices who were appointed by one side, but maybe weren't as ideologically pure and might cross over more. Justice Stevens was appointed by a Republican and became one of the most liberal justices on the court. So I think he's correct about ideology always influencing the court and policy preferences influencing the court. But the partisanship today, I think, is even stronger. And that's in part because the presidents have been even more concerned with ensuring that they get their policy preferences based on who they appoint. So it's always been a problem, but I think it's a worse problem today than it had been in the past.
Chemerinsky advocates for a constitutional convention to update our guiding principles according to modern conditions. Some say opening the Constitution for a revision could quickly lead to a slippery slope. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's obviously a concern. Once you start opening things to change, who knows what else can get in there. And, you know, he wants to retain the best parts of the Constitution and get rid of the worst parts. I think it's always okay to have these conversations. And we also see states changing their constitutions all the time through ballot referendum, right? State constitutions are a lot easier to change. But I guess my question is, we really need to have that conversation about who's going to be in the room and the parameters for the kinds of conversations we're going to have if we do open up that Pandora's box.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host. Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm the series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Landon Palmer, research assistant, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. If you'd like to get in touch, our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.